Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The legendary Apache warrior Geronimo surrendered to U.S. troops in 1886. He succinctly said, "Once I moved like the wind, now I surrender to you, and that is all." Now I Surrender is the name of the latest novel by Álvaro Enrique. Geronimo and his band of Chiricahua Apaches are a running thread through the book, which spans multiple timelines over two centuries. The book explores the run-up to, the end of, and the aftermath of the Indian Wars through several seemingly disconnected storylines. One is set in 1836 in the small city of Janos in what's today the Mexican state of Chihuahua. Mexico at the time was a fledgling republic. The widow Camila flees into the desert after Janos is raided. She is swept up by an Apache rider and disappears. The Mexican Lieutenant Colonel Jose Maria Zuluaga has been ordered to find Camila. He strings together a ragtag army of soldiers who can brave crossing Apacheria, the vast land of the Apache Indians, which by that time included modern-day Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and northern Mexico. And then there's the narrator, whose observations are interspersed throughout the book. He's a present-day New York academic and native of Mexico who feels pulled to visit Apacheria to see where Geronimo surrendered and where he died as a prisoner of war. The author of Now I Surrender, Álvaro Enrique, is himself a native of Mexico and a New York academic at Hofstra University. He's the author of the acclaimed novel You Dreamed of Empires. That book was a fantastical psychedelic take on Hernán Cortés's 1519 encounter with Moctezuma when the Aztec and Spanish empires collided. Enrique's novel Sudden Death centers partly around a tennis match between the Spanish poet Francisco de Quevedo and Italian painter Caravaggio, who were playing an epic game of tennis with balls made of Anne Boleyn's hair. Enrique says Now I Surrender still centers on real historical figures, but told with less fantastical elements, and focuses on an important but little-known era of American history.
Maybe here there is an important factual note. This book is previous to You Dream of Empires. It's just that in the planning of the publishing house and considering that there was a very heavy pandemic in the middle, this one was put to aside. And when we were going to begin to work in the new one, but there is the older one, so we decided to put this later. So I think that that's important because maybe there is a sequence between the books, but I am not sure. What matters in your question is, I believe that this book is less imaginative, let's say, that uses less, not completely, because there are many things that are not real there, of course, many. But I think that I care it to be less fantastic. And I love the term fantastic because that's the word we use in Latin America for the kind of work I do. Is because this was a story that, as you said, is not very well known. And more importantly for me, it's a story that is not well known at all in Mexico. The Apache Wars are seen like an American phenomenon in Mexico. This comes, of course, because as Americans, we have the information of the Westerns and the pulp fiction about cowboys, etc. So the involvement of Mexico in the Apache Wars was not well known or is not well known in Mexico. It's a subject of specialists. And I think that, as you can see in the novel, that Mexico had an enormous responsibility in that tremendously cruel and infamous war. So I was making a big effort to propose the Mexican point of view of a conflict that at the end, I think, ended up, as all traumas do, marking the life of both countries. I felt that I could write this novel, because as so many of us, I'm a Mexican in the US, so I had the feeling that I could understand a little bit more than a Mexican from Mexico could understand the conflict. You know, it was important for me to tell the story from the Mexican point of view.
And to me, it's interesting that the Apaches are such a footnote in history, considering the fact that they lived in these areas for centuries. And your book focuses sort of, well, there are many timelines in this book, but I think sort of the central timeline in this book takes place in the late 1800s, mid to late 1800s. And again, it just seems so easy, and you bring this up in your book, for us to forget such an important part of history, to become relegated to a footnote, to where even Apache descendants almost feel like they have to whisper their ancestry so that nobody realizes that they are Apache, because to be Apache was to be considered one of the bad guys. In the stories of the West, the Apaches and the Comanches are the ones who are considered the bad guys, and that tale is what is remembered in the history we know today.
Well, yes, history is written by the winners. It's not that the novel dares to propose an Apache point of view. That has been done a lot of times, and you just have to go to any bookstore in the Southwest to see that there are lots of testimonies and academic works that tell that story from the point of view of the Apache Nation. For me, I can tell you when this novel began, and that may frame the fact that I spent so many years researching it and writing it. And is that one day I am in the Library of Congress. I think that I was still living in Mexico. I think that it was a work trip, or maybe I had just moved to New York, but this is 15, 16, 70 years ago. I am in the Library of Congress, and there is a beautiful exhibition of maps. Obviously, I'm attracted to the maps that involve Mexico, naturally, like a fly to honey. So I see one of these beautiful maps, and in it, there was the colonies, the American colonies already in expansion, Mexico still with the size that it had before the war of 47. And then between those two countries, there is a political demarcation that says Apacheria. I don't even remember if the map was Mexican or American, but it impressed me enormously, the fact that in certain moment, a cartographer considered that Apacheria was a nation in its own. That is something that as a Mexican, you never know. I don't know as an American, but as a Mexican, you don't even suspect that. And the fact, of course, that the image of the Apaches as a resistant nation, it's always strong in us, even when they are negatively portrayed. It's a nation many times negatively portrait in the TV programs that we saw when we were children and the films that we saw when we were children. The idea of a political entity with borders that lie between Mexico and the United States make me thought that things are not like they have been told to us. So I began to read about that conflict, the original conflict between the Apache Nation and the Spanish Empire, then the conflict with the Mexican Republic, and then the conflict with the recently arrived to the Southwest American Army.
Álvaro Enrique is the author of Now I Surrender. The book is translated from Spanish by Natasha Wimmer. When we come back, Mexico's little explored history with the Apache inspired Álvaro Enrique to dive deep into research to tell the story through his characters.
And one of the interests was to write a novel about that period in that time. And of course, my love story with the history of the Apache Nation that dates long before the beginning of writing this novel.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras.
Strong local journalism does not happen by accident. It happens because listeners choose to invest in it. TPR's spring fundraising drive begins March 11th, and our focus is sustaining the future of TPR. Monthly sustaining members provide the steady support that allows us to cover important local stories and host thoughtful conversations across South Central Texas. You can start right now. Become a sustaining member today and help keep trusted reporting strong. Make your monthly gift at tpr.org.
Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. To read Álvaro Enríguez's novel, Now I Surrender, is to take time away from it for a deep Google dive to learn about the book's historical Native characters who played an important yet forgotten role and how their West was lost. Enrique writes that it's a story that started with Don Juan de Oñate's expedition into New Mexico in 1598 and ended with the burial of the last Apache prisoners of war at Fort Sill in Oklahoma in the early 1900s. The names of warriors like Nana, Naiche, and Mangas Coloradas once stirred fear and respect. They've mostly been forgotten in mainstream history in the course of a century. Their names and stories are resurrected in Now I Surrender. It's a novel that is itself divided into three books. The first is called Janos. It toggles back and forth between the 1800s, where the search is on for Camila, a Mexican woman who disappeared after an Apache raid in the town of Janos, and the present day, where a Mexican-born academic is reckoning with his country's role in the fall of Apacheria. I ask Enrique if the narrator is him.
Yes and not. Everything that goes into a novel becomes a novel. The digestive system of fiction takes everything and makes what can be the biographical information of a person, it transforms it in fiction because fiction has different rules than reality, and things in, I don't know, square A have to have correspondence in square Z. So the faint relationship between the narrator and myself as the novel was evolving changed tremendously. I was interested in that first part that you mentioned in a period of Mexican history that I didn't know that well and about which I read a lot, and that is very intriguing for me. That is those first 25 or 26 years of the Mexican Republic, in which what is now the southwest of the United States was still Mexico. Mexico really consolidates as a nation after the Mexican-American War, and more than anything after the French invasion, that is still called by the historians the second independence of Mexico. So I was interested in those nebulous years in a zone of the country that was just part of the country for 26 years. These are, in a novel, are converging interests. No? And one of the interests was to write a novel about that period in that time. And of course, my love story with the history of the Apache Nation that dates long before the beginning of writing this novel. In order to put all of that together, there was a moment in which I understood that I needed to center the novel in one character, and I did that. And in order to be able to tell the enormous history of the Apache Nation in a novel, I needed a narrator that was in the contemporary world. For me, it's always very important, and I think that you can see it in all my books that have been translated into English. For me, it's very important to confront the sensibilities of the past with our contemporary sensibility. As St. Paul says that we write, and it's not that I'm a Catholic, but I'm a big fan of the writing of St. Paul. I think that he was unbelievably intelligent. St. Paul says that we keep writing to give testimony of our time. So for me, it was very important to have a character that could put together the many stories that explained the story of the generation of Chiricahua Apaches that is told in the novel. And that was the function of this person that is traveling through the Southwest so that person could, by one hand, give testimony of what is left of that world. That, by the way, is a lot. No? Apache Nation, it's still there, and it's perfectly healthy. And by the other side, there were so many stories to be told so a reader can understand how that war happened, that I needed a different narrator.
I thought it was really interesting when you get into book two of Now I Surrender, you almost take a shift. Book one kind of ends on a cliffhanger. What happens to Camila, this woman who has been taken? And then all of a sudden you are shifted into the ways that the U.S. military is attempting to get Geronimo to surrender, their battles with the administrators in Washington, D.C., with the president, with the Secretary of War, who want to instead, you know, try Geronimo and kill him. And all of a sudden, you're like, wait a minute, we just took this left turn. What happened at the end of book one? But then you see, as this novel unfolds and you get to book three, which is the shortest section of this book, that it all resolves really beautifully. You stuck through it all and you get this sort of beautiful prize at the end, and you see how it all just completely comes together. Can you talk to us a little bit about that process?
This conversation, I love it, is mainly about process. I'm just afraid of getting your listeners bored because you are just getting so into the workshop, you know, in the everyday job of a writer. But thank you for using the word beautiful, because I think that it's all about that still. Novels are political. Novels are many things, are a tool to place ourselves in the shoes of others. Novels have many reasons to exist, but the pursuit of beauty is still very important for me. So I'm thankful for you using that adjective. Said so, I think that you can understand the way I work. If you imagine young Álvaro, I don't know, like 19-year-old, maybe 21 years old, maybe 23, dreaming about becoming a writer and reading Conversación in la Catedral, Conversation in the Cathedral, I think it's named in English, by Mario Vargas Llosa, that it's a novel that happens in many times, and those times begin to run simultaneously by the end of the novel. And I spent years dissecting that novel to understand how he did it. I never understood it. I think that there is an opacity in true genius. So I really never understand the trick. But what I can tell you that can be very disappointing for your listeners is that I work by hand. I write by hand. And I write in different notebooks, different stories. And then at the end, I move all of that to the computer, and when I am working in the computer, I begin slowly, mainly because I get bored easily, to mix the stories until they are together and there is a general resolution. So it's a very technical thing. It's my everyday job. For me, it's important because as a reader, when I see my own novels, what I see, Norma, are like boxes and vectors uniting. What I see is structures. But when I read another novel, novels written by different people, I'm still the 16-year-old kid who would spend the night reading while everybody was sleeping at home. So I just love that sensation that you have in certain magistral books of understanding a literary truth in a moment. The moment in which you can make all the connections inside the book and you are like, oh, this is fantastic. And of course, in a very humble way, I would love to reproduce that sensation in the readers. I see literature in part, of course, it's a vocation and I would do it in any circumstance. I just love it. I just love to write. But I see it also as a service. No? So you should provide certain emotions as a writer, and that emotion is very expensive for me, let's say, this moment of awe in which you understand what is going on.
I don't know why I'm talking to you so much about process, but these are a lot of the notes that I had for myself when I was reading this book. The first book of the book is, one long chapter. The paragraphs are what divide your timelines and your first-person narrator character who's in the modern day, like you said earlier. The second book, it's set up more like chapters. And the final book, there's no more spacing. Towards the final pages of the book, the timelines and the sentences are back to back to back to back to back. It's almost like it's in this, I don't know what a word is I'm looking for, maybe a flux, a final crescendo maybe, until you get to that finale of the symphony, I guess, if I can continue using that metaphor.
Well, I am a sentimental man, Norma. So I, while people is watching TV series that are magistral, I'm listening to operas. For me, since the beginning of the novel, that I knew that was going to be a polyphonic, I love that we are forced to speak about music. It's a polyphonic novel. You know, there are a lot of voices, a lot of things going on all the time. And for me, it was very important, had the adjective before writing the last book of the novel, that it was an operatic ending, you know, that everybody could be in the proscenium and really singing loud, and the orchestra could be like going crazy. And if I were incredibly lucky, one person in the world could read it and cry a little bit. That's, as a writer, to be able to produce like real emotions in another physical body is victory, because it's a change in reality. I don't think, like Julio Cortázar used to think, and he's a very important writer for me, that you can change the world writing and reading books. But I think that you can change at least just physiology for a little second. And that is total success. So that was the idea with that enormous ending, or enormous for me. I don't know how it really works for a reader, of course, but in which the whole orchestra and the whole characters are giving their best to leave you with a sensation of satisfaction.
Well, I know this book was actually published a few years ago in Spanish. Can you tell us about the process of working with this translator, Natasha Wimmer, who I know has worked with you in past books? I know that there are people who, they might be reluctant to see their work translated because there are certain words that just don't translate, or certain thoughts or certain phrases. Tell us about the process that you worked with Natasha Wimmer in this book and even in your past books with her.
There is this position that many writers that I admire enormously have, that is that there is something sacred about the literary text that should not be touched. So you should just let it go as it was. I have more of a middle-class ethos, and I believe in working. I'm still the first one to wake up in the neighborhood. My light is still the first one that turns on in the morning to work. And in that working ethos, I see the translation into English, because it's the only language that is not a first language for me, but is the only language, foreign language, in which I am completely fluent. I see it as a second opportunity. And to work with Natasha Wimmer is just maybe the biggest privilege that I have had. I don't like the adjective, but as a professional writer in my life, because I see how, I don't know, it's like making bread. I see her putting the ingredients, letting it rise, and then I see her put it in the oven to have the final shape. Natasha, I could talk about Natasha's work forever, but the way she does it is she produces a very raw first draft, and then she begins to sculpt and sculpt and sculpt on it. And in the middle, she lets me read it and send notes. So we have a lot of pages full of notes of both of us, discussing sometimes a joke, sometimes a whole history, but many times a single word. This doesn't mean this, that. So I would not say that it's a collaboration, because my voice in English is Natasha's voice, and it's different than mine. So it's not exactly a collaboration, but I am so happy to help. I enjoy so much the process of seeing her rewrite the novel. And many times when we are doing that, I discover that one page was necessary here, that this story was not so good here. So the original in English changes a lot in comparison to the original in Spanish, being always, of course, I insist, the voice of Natasha.
Do you find yourself maybe rediscovering parts of your own work that have come up in a translation? Maybe something, oh, I didn't realize that's what I meant to say, but that's what I meant to say.
Natasha understands my book much better than myself, Norma. It has happened with the three of them. And I can tell you that many times I'm so ashamed when she discovers something. So yeah, the translation process make many things that when I'm in this like transportive state in which I enter when I'm writing are not clear for me. So as I'm telling you, it's like a second chance to produce a better book. I'm with the comfort that is not my voice, the voice that is compromised this time.
Well, with the time we have left, I know we haven't really talked too much about the book itself, but if you were to tell people what is your book about and how is it being told through these characters? How would you respond?
I have this conversation with a friend, and I am not comparing myself by any means, Norba, but I have this conversation with a friend. We are into Hamlet, and I don't know what Hamlet is about. And it's a 500 year, I don't know. It's a very old piece that we all adore, and we still don't understand well. Imagine the degree of confusion with my own work. Nevertheless, I think that it's a story about resistance. I can tell you that what moved me of the story of the final surrender of the Chiricahua Apaches, that I insist that it's just a little family of the Apache world. The Apache nation is there, and it's happy and complete and in their territory and keeping the language and the uses. But what was so moving for me was the way in which they resisted, the amount of fear that people had of them, about them in Mexico, when they were a tiny little army. The fact that the Mexican army really could never submit them to the rule of the Republic, and they were just cornered because the Americans entered to the equation. So I think that story of resistance for a professional coward as me, it's very moving. I wish I could be like that. I wish that I was that fearless. I wish that I could just keep going and going no matter what. That produces an admiration in me. I think that I write the novels I write with the same organ with which I see the World Cup. I'm always like complaining about the corruption of FIFA, about how soccer has become the opium of the people, about how we should boycott that anyway. But when the ball begins to roll, I become a 9-year-old again. And I think that I write from that point of view still, no? with the awe of a child, with the admiration of a child, and with the will to become something like what I'm talking about when I get older. The problem is that I'm getting older, and as Gruber says, I'm same old me. I don't change. but I think that it was that, you know, the incredible, incredible power and resistance of a last generation that decided to not surrender until surrendering became a survival tool, a negotiating survival tool.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left, and is there anything that I have not asked you about that you'd like to talk about, or any final words?
I spent my whole education, Norma, without raising my hand, from kindergarten to the last class of the PhD, I never had a question. So, as you can see, if you read my books, I'm a person that is desperate with questions and trying to answer about mysteries of the past. But I never have anything to add, and I think that I have that problem with when I write short stories, for example. When it's done, it's done. I cannot produce a perfect ending. The same thing with the articles. So no, I never have anything to add. Once my editor in Spanish asked me, "Could you help us with the," I don't remember the word in English now, "with the last page of the novel." It would be, I'm showing you a book.
Yes.
It would be this, the back cover of
Yes.
a book. And I was like, well, print the whole novel with tiny, tiny little letters and put it there. I don't have anything else to say. No, it's so hard to write a novel that I just hope that I can move someone, you know? That someone can go to Arizona, travel to Arizona, and see that landscape with the 9-year-old boy eyes with which I see it when I go there. No, same thing, of course, with Chihuahua, Sonora, West Texas, etc., the land of Apacherian.
Well, Alvaro Enrique, a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much.
The pleasure was completely mine, Norman. I promise you to be more lucid the next time.
Alvaro Enrique is the author of Now I Surrender, translated to English by Natasha Wimmer. He's also the author of the New York Times Top 10 Book of the Year, You Dreamed of Empires. Enrique teaches Latin American literature at Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Fronteras editors are Dan Katz and Yvette Benavides. Chiranga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thanks for listening.